Good evening, everyone, and welcome to I guess this is an Evelyn's Corner stream since you've got most of this together, Evelyn. You're gonna introduce yourself to the nice boys and girls?
No, I'm not, because you already know who I am. I don't have to introduce myself. No introductions needed.
Fair, fair. I'll put a quick refresh in the chat. We'll do some of the normal YouTube-y stuff before we get started, just so people know what's happening. Through some miracle of science, we're still monetized, so if you want to send super chats and become a member, you can do. But the best way to support us, as we talk about on every one of these, is to donate through Streamlabs. You can have your question read out. It's the link in the description there. I'm sure you can just put it in the chat.
I will add
We
that.
all. Yes, we also we're not going to be lax on doing additional shilling for other people as well. If you want to buy AA's book, it is available from Amazon if you're outside the US, and directly from Imperium Press if you are within the US. So those are the two best places to get The Populist Delusion by Nima Parvini.
It's Mr. Panini. We've got
Yeah, it.
Quiznos. We've got bread mold. We're building the sandwich mafia.
Yes, we are. I have been making continuously making the Nina Panini joke,
Is
and this
this
is
why
cook
people
is
are a bit Marmite with me?
it... Oh, maybe. The bread puns have begun and they won't stop. But yes, hello everyone. We do read the chat, by the way. We're not just super chat whores. So I will read if you put messages in there. So audience interaction is encouraged, but mostly we're going to be talking today around the book, but we also have some excerpts from it.
I was going to say beforehand, thank you to AA for rescheduling his stream. He was going to do it at the exact same time so that he can get the maximum value and eyeballs on the free advertising we're doing for him. Very welcome.
Yes, it's mutual back scratching of the most painful shilling degree.
Yeah, for whoever this person he knows is called, as you said, Nina Parts Mini or whatever it is, that everyone's favourite rug merchant. Seems to be
Yes.
hawking this book for some reason.
It's got secret subliminal messages in it about buying Persian rugs, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, quackademic agent, if he was a bad doctor or actually just a duck. What I'm going to start with this one then. I know a few people have been. I have a couple of people in the chat were confused as to whether or not the bug had come out. Yes, it has come out. But also, do you want to give a quick overview since you were the one who read it first? I've only just read it. I only read it a couple of days ago, but finished reading it a couple of days ago. So it's still very fresh in my mind. But if you were to describe this to someone who didn't quite know what was up, and wanted a quick kind of overview introduction, what would you say The Populist Delusion entails?
Well, no, I think to anyone that knows ever so slightly, it's like a great sort of update and addition to The Machiavellians by Burnham, because he talks about a fair few of the same thinkers, the sort of the elite school, and that sort of term school I think we'll come back to later because it's something I think we need to be thinking about more in regards to canon, this, that, and the next thing. But he's giving you an introductory sort of look at the iron law of oligarchy, at Schmitt's understanding of the friend-enemy distinction, Schmitt's conception of sovereignty, all these different little things that we've been talking about on some length across this whole kind of sphere, really, for quite a wee while. And partly because I think AA has really been one of the main people that's been driving a lot of the reading and engagement with that material. So it's no surprise really that some of this will actually probably be familiar in conclusion to a lot of the people who are familiar with the content and maybe aren't big readers themselves. So maybe in that way it's a good insight to get yourself started reading, possibly, because it's a short book. It's not too complex language wise, and I think the way the sort of ideas and the contents are handled is it's easy to grasp. There's not too much reading required beforehand. The same with Burnham's Machiavellians, and the reason why these are arguably both very good books, and I think I described them as, I might even get the image up just for the sake of entertainment, but as almost like pamphlets.
Yes.
They take a very, very, we do that rare thing of taking a very, very high level concept, like some of the elite theory kind of characteristics and then actually boil it down into something that you could give to someone who was at least mildly politically read, and they would be able to understand it.
I must say, another book it reminds me of, and there's basically one in stock on Amazon. Oh, no, it's temporarily out of stock still. It's okay. Nemesis is the book I was talking about, and it's one we've talked about on stream before, mm-hmm. by C.A. Bond, also from Imperium Press. But since it was essentially withdrawn by I think the author basically disappeared. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what the situation is with Nemesis. But here in the UK, at least, you cannot really get it on Amazon. I think there's maybe one being sold secondhand somewhere. There's like one in stock, but I'll put, if you guys want the one copy of Nemesis that's left, I'll
one, so ours is worth more. We used to bought so many copies of that when it came out.
Oh god, Nemesis is one of those books where I think that if this does take off and, you know, we do start actually winning, everyone's going to claim that they bought it at the time. They'll be like, it'll be like everyone who claimed they saw Nirvana before Nevermind came out, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if it was really true, there'd be like 20,000 people at all the early shows.
Oh yeah, I was really at the first Shieldings event. Were you?
I don't remember seeing
As Mr. Panini has described himself many times, it's the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
You don't know, man. You weren't there.
You weren't there, man. No, you weren't really at the first Shieldings event unless you had cigar smoke blown in your face and got funny looks from the staff who kept turning the lights out outside. Right, in a designated smoking area. And yeah, Charlemagne, well done for snagging yourself a copy of Nemesis, because that book will hopefully be worth some serious money one day. But we're getting a little bit into the weeds here. Shall we start off? We should probably start off with that quite large quote, I think. We'll start off with a section of the book and give people a taster of what this is all about, because there's quite a large section here we picked out from his chapter about Schmidt, which is, I think, is a good place to start. Does anyone want to structure this? If you want to, I'll read the first bit.
Let me quickly shape the OBS one properly, because I've got it. But
yes.
I've just got it in the Google Doc, so we can just kind of read that.
Yeah, that's fine. Zoom in a little bit so people can. I'll read the first bit, then you can read the Spengler quote, and then I'll read the bit off after the Spengler quote, because the Spengler quote is quite long. So.
Cool.
Yes, he's talking about the myths of the neutral state in this chapter. I didn't want to put too much in. It's quite a long quote already, but this is in the context of the myth of the neutral state. But it starts off. Viewed in this way, a state wedded to liberal democracy is as totalitarian as any other, since, by its very nature, it will be unable to tolerate any leaders who are not always already liberal democrats. Nick Clegg flashbacks. Should such leaders arise, the stalwarts of liberal democracy will perceive them as populists, fascists, threats to democracy, and so on. The extent of free speech, free inquiry, free thought, and so on, is a liberal delusion. In fact, the range of thought and so on in the range of allowable opinion is always exceedingly narrow, and the liberal democratic state is marked by its intolerance and spectacular inability to imagine any worldview that is not its own. The dominance of liberal political ideology is total. Schmidt would not have disagreed with Oswald Spengler, who wrote The Decline of the West.
England, too, discovered the ideal of a free press, and discovered along with it that the press serves him who owns it. It does not spread free opinion, it generates it. Without the readers observing it, the paper, and himself with it, changes masters. Here also money triumphs and forces the free spirits into its service. No tamer has his animals more under his power. Unleash the people as reader mass, and it will storm through the streets and hurl itself upon the target indicated, terrifying and breaking windows. A hint to the press staff, and it will all become quiet and go home. The press today is an army with carefully organised arms and branches, with journalists as officers and readers as soldiers. But here, as in every army, the soldier obeys blindly, and war aims and operation plans change without his knowledge. The reader neither knows, nor is allowed to know, the purpose for which he is used, nor even the role that he used to play. A more appalling caricature of freedom of thought cannot be imagined. Formerly, a man did not dare to think freely. Now he dares but cannot. His will to think is only a willingness to think to order, and this is what he feels as his liberty.
The chapter then goes on to say, as Edward Bernays would go on to say, these are the invisible rulers who control the destinies of millions. In some department of our daily lives, in which we imagine ourselves as free agents, we are ruled by dictators exercising great power. The point is that, viewed from the outside, liberal democracy looks just as totalitarian as any other regime, even if it relies more on subtle persuasion, nudge techniques, and other psychological tricks than coercion to obtain its results. In Prato's terms, liberal democracy leads to rule by foxes as opposed to lions. Liberal democracy rules, as Schmitt was later to call it, by a tyranny of values, in which anti-liberal, anti-democratic, anti-materialist thinking is beyond the pale and banished from polite society. Some have been quick to point out Schmitt's cynical hypocrisy for complaining when the boot was on the other foot, so to speak, but it is perfectly consistent with his friend-enemy distinction. When friends are in power and imposing their values, that is good. When enemies are in power and imposing theirs, that is bad. This is politics. War by another name. As Paul Gottfried argues, Schmitt wishes us to know that no amount of neutralization can render human relations apolitical. However earnestly, we strive for a programmed and peaceful society. The political, as friend-enemy distinction, continues to resurface. So that's quite a long section there, but it's very... The stuff about Schmitt, I think, is very central because it's towards the front of the book. It's quite early on, the Schmitt chapter. It's quite essential to contextualizing the rest of what he's saying about populism and what he's saying about all these different thinkers' objections to and kind of not debunking, but incompatibility with the populist delusion, the central thesis of the book. It's really about attacking it from all these different angles and using it as a framing device to bring forth all of these, you know, authors of the dissident right that we've come to identify with, but really have, apart from this, no codified recent summation of. Like you mentioned earlier, the closest thing, you're right, I can think to it is the Machiavellians, where Burnham is going through and categorizing all these different people who are very influential to Western political thought.
That's also partially because we still really haven't cracked Leviathan and its enemies yet, as we've talked about a million times, but that book is a chronicle in and of itself, and we will probably continue to talk about that book for God knows how long to come. That will, as we have said before, if anything goes well, will become a staple book of any distant right bookshelf. But not that I quite like the stuff in here where there is some really sort of punchy deliverance of, you know, this is politics. There is no should or ought about it. There is the friend-enemy distinction. There is elsewhere in the book, as he mentions, you know, the iron law of oligarchy from, is that Kells, I think. Or the iron law of organization, or whatever name you want to give it. You know, these are facts of life in the truest sense. You know, this is literally how human organization has to function if it's going to be political. And I think, in the same sense, we're almost brewing a kind of toolkit in the way that the Austrians, by the time you get to Mises, you end up with this model of social science, in a certain sense, where you can discern things that are or aren't productive towards his ideas of sort of social cohesion and production, and all these different elements. We are sort of almost building a similar kind of thing. You know, some of these things you can use as building blocks and build a sort of deductive system of logic around, and a sort of almost anti-human action. You know, if you're not going to have cooperation in society, then you must have this. And maybe that's, you know, there are so many elements to that that I think...
You think?
Scrum Benevolence shortchanged me one of book by sharing one book between two. Yes, we did. Like, we weren't getting it for free, so we got our money's worth out of it.
It's. I'm afraid that's how having physical products works.
Yeah.
You can actually pass them on. That book's gonna do numbers though. It's probably gonna get lent out to a couple of people who might not otherwise read it. But we're spreading the good word, comrade. We're embracing the Leninism aspect. But go on, Evelyn.
Oh yeah, that would be the thing, of course. That the hand around this sort of tatty copy of the Populist Delusion with everyone's signatures in it that read it. It's a sort of souvenir.
That'd be kind of cool. But it's like you said, there's a lot of analysis here of the older authors, of the keepers of the flame, as it were, here. And another presence, I think, that isn't mentioned here, because he's quite widespread and quite well known in these circles, is someone like Hans Hermann Hoppe. We'll get to some of his stuff about grand historical narratives near the end of this. But
I can't believe
Hoppe,
this in
again.
the chat here. Think of the starving author. Think of the starving reader. It wasn't even big bucks over here that paid for that book. It was little old me that did so.
You did. You paid for it. She had to raid her piggy bank.
I know. I had to scrape together all my pennies
Please,
for that book.
please, Nina Panini. We can't buy any more rugs. We
I
are bankrupt.
know. I'm out in the street wearing a potato sack and a shoelace, and but at least I've got my copy of The Populist Delusion.
He does. He needs his sugar. His sugar.
Sorry,
But
I
anyway.
interrupted you. On you go.
No, I was just saying that there another kind of big presence here when it comes to democracy and a lot of the critiques of especially this kind of desperate cope. It's like the right is clinging on with its fingernails to this idea that they can go through the system and have this populist, like, although it's like Martin Luther King moment. And it needs to be like we need to get like a big stick and beat it out of them, and that's kind of what this does from a few different angles.
Well,
But
yeah,
it does remind.
it's definitely something I still notice. People want to talk at great lengths of, elite theory or this thinker or that thinker or the Romans or this classical thing and how based it is, and then they still go and then argue for really basic bitch like populist conservatism. And
Yeah.
it's embarrassing, really, and I think that's one of the things that especially, you mentioned Hoppe there, who does that from a libertarian spin, and I think Francis very much does that from the more sort of paleocon spin, where he was lamenting time and time again at the just, at stuff like MLK Day. I mean, how is that something that Reagan should be putting forward?
There's all that stuff as well about Sam Francis essentially telling Pat Buchanan not to cuck the fuck out. And he unfortunately did. That's a piece of slightly obscure
Yeah, but
historica.
then again, James Buchanan, the same man that got rid of Revelio P. Oliver from the very early National Review for saying that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist.
Oh man, there's too many spicy people. One of the original skits posters. Thank you, Mr. Palindrome, very skits. But shall we move on to this next quote then, since you seem to have it hovering on screen?
I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if you were going to segue into it or not, but I shall go on with this one.
Oh no, I was going to segue into it by saying that we've read a bit of the chapter, near the end of the chapter, on Schmidt. There's another chapter here which is on Samuel Francis, because the three things I think it's what I want to cover here was Schmidt and to an extent Spengler, Francis, and then Gottfried, because there's some great stuff in here that is really, it's almost a refutation of some of the recent watered down mold bug we've been seeing.
Yes.
If you remember that article we went over a couple of weeks ago that was essentially about the neutral cathedral, when they were trying to say that there is no man behind the curtain, the cathedral's just this great big neutral entity, and it just happens, guys. All of these things just happen.
Thank you, Charlie, in the chat for saying the fact that he was listening to the newest Amren video and Jared Taylor is far too liberal for my tastes. Is that because is he just gone really soft, or are we that far ahead now? That's
I
the
think we
that's
are
the, that's
we
the
are just
question
that
to
far
ruminate
ahead.
on.
We're seeing the Matrix far too hard. Do you want to read this one, or should I?
I can, that's... yeah. The second objection to Burnham with which Francis deals is the idea that the managerial elite are not unified, but rather a plurality. In fact, such objections were also applied to the works of Mills and his followers. Francis had in mind the work of Robert Dow, David Truman, John Kenneth Galbraith, David Reisman, and Arnold M. Rose. As we have seen, Francis largely deals with this by acknowledging that while entry into the elite is possible,
it's narrow.
Yeah, so no, it's just because it's got the slightly warping thing to it. It's narrow and exclusively managerial character, which emphasizes special qualifications and skills and practices, gives it a uniformity that is rare in history. He points out, citing Mosca, that the old capitalist entrepreneurial regime and even the old feudal system were much more diverse in terms of the makeup of the ruling class. The third objection came from the libertarians of the Reagan era, who argued that the new managerial regime is being eclipsed by the rise of newly minted entrepreneurs. Today's minds may instinctively turn to a man like Bill Gates, or perhaps the Silicon Valley types such as Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and Peter Thiel. But virtually none of these billionaires are entrepreneurs in a manner that, say, Henry Ford was. They each made their fortune by playing the system of the managerial regime and exploiting the fusion of the state and the economy in one way or another. But even if there should spring forth a genuinely innovative and entrepreneurial firm, sooner or later it becomes co-opted and transformed into being part of the regime apparatus. Francis cites the example of McDonald's. A more recent example might be Google. I think as well, is this not the chapter where he then pulls the bit out from C.A. Bond, where he talks about the nature of the corporation, which I think...
Yes, it is.
These sort of things go hand in hand, and I think it takes people who really want to kind of push themselves a little bit to grasp the dynamics of it, because it's something I've kind of thought about before, not in the terms of the managerial revolution, but as policy basically dictated that any successful, you know, large capitalist entity, quote unquote, had to be publicly owned with a board and a certain number of shares distributed amongst a certain number of people. You are
it must also have a good relationship with the merchant banking class
class. That's a whole different issue. But just on the nature of, you know, like shares and, you know, the ownership of the company literally being split up onto these bits of paper that are almost like a sort of social contract you have with the organization that says you're owed a certain part of it and therefore can input, you know, 10% of the decision making or something. You know, you've basically just democratized large swathes of industry, and at the same time you have these sort of manager people that fill these boards, who all have the same doctrines, they all read the same business theory or the same management theory or the same, you know, economic stuff. It's all, you know, that weird Keynesian bubble of the faking gay economy where these people exist. And therefore, that, you know, that does he less here, someone like Henry Ford, the idea of an actual owner entrepreneur business is basically made completely impossible. So there is there is no sovereignty in running a business nowadays. You're completely subservient to the managerial system.
If you look at the examples stated here, you had Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, the tech billionaires are all made by angel investors.
Normally related either to Alphabet agencies or just directly the Pentagon.
That came slightly after, but in trying to, you know, reel in the Alphabet agency and the Pentagon, and, you know, anyone who knows anything knows that majority of the money from Google and Amazon, when they became really, really big, came from the fact that they were selling your data to the government. And that is what is their biggest kind of kick in the backside when it came to their status within society. It really codified them as kind of too big to fail in the tech sense because they're such allies of the security state. But before that, you get these hedge funds that have, you know, good relationships that are essentially just arms of the large reserve banks.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in and they pump in, say, $500 million. And no, Mark Zuckerberg hasn't owned Facebook really in the entire time it's been a large entity. It's owned by the investors. and it's owned by the stakeholders. And someone who is like a Henry Ford, who is, you know, these large family businesses who will have investors, but it's still essentially a fiefdom. It's a kingdom. And you're right, we've got it. It's the corporation itself has lost sovereignty in that sense. It has followed the same trajectory that states in general have done, in that the idea of the CEO as king in the mold of a Henry Ford is completely gone. You must have some bow to the public interest. And if you don't, as we've seen with some of the performative stuff about social media companies, you'll be hauled before Congress and told to heal for various different reasons. It's an interesting point, and it's something that a lot of people, you're right, it's a bit of a shit test whether you understand how modern corporations don't fit in with quote-unquote the unrestricted capitalism that people go on about. I guess it is just an IQ test. But again, the other thing here is that there is no neutrality. There is no idea that the managerial class, yes, they exist, but they're not unified, is one of the objections. And I think this does skewer it quite conclusively, that they are, as evidenced by their existence and who they are and what they are, you can just look at them and see how hegemonic they are and see how tightly ideologically grouped they are and see how self-policing they are.
It's almost in a point made in a Lul, where the more technically specialized your work becomes, in the way that it would be if you were...
I just want to might zoom in a little bit on the Google Docs so people can, if they've missed a bit, can read it a bit easier. It fills the screen a bit more.
No, fair enough. That notion that, specialized technical work actually becomes more uniform the more specialized it gets, not less, because you're dealing with tiny iterations on the same process, or you're dealing with a process that's so perfected that it's just never going to change anymore. And you can sort of see that in, or at least see the why people might act as if that, or perceive the operation in some sort of specialized industry as being like that. There may be some change that does come around, but that's something of an unseen nature. You know, it's not something you actively think about whilst at work. So he even goes on to lengths to describe that a lot of people involved in this kind of work then have a detachment of psychology and action, so that they're engaging in the action of this highly technical work that should be a task for them, and it's not anymore. So their brain just kind of goes off and wanders. But a slightly unrelated point, but in the same sense here, we are seeing that the people who manage organizations, as opposed to the people who own and run organizations, are not attached to the process of technically operating the thing as a holistic entity as a whole. They deal with a department or a sector or a branch or a process. So there is no wisdom about how the whole machine runs, in a subjective sense. There is only the objective measures of performance from 12 departments.
Yep, and that is, again, that is how the autopilot part of it works. But if you inject some will into them, that you inject some non-neutralizing force, like that's the pillar here. This is how the Spengler and the Schmidt interacts with the Burnham and the Francis. In that, what you get here is, if you can't have a political policy, you can't have a political business policy, you can't have a political action within organizations, it is impossible to wield power in an apolitical way. It does not exist. And that's not saying, oh, herder, everything's political, fucking sexist gravity.
It's a very simple point from Yockey, actually. If there is any entity, and entities we're talking about here are organizations, you are either, not in a Marxist sense, but in a political sense, and the sort of the way that those political games are limited within their bounds, being at the friend-enemy distinction, the iron law of oligarchy, and these things that we're going over here. You can either work to promote an organization you're a part of, or you can let it die. And I sort of say, if the thing's not thriving, it's dying. And he uses that to talk about, cultures or political parties and big scale organizations. But in terms of you know, as you're saying, neutral action, trying to act neutrally in regards to any organization is actually just a way to kind of kill it or sort of hold it in suspension. It's not capable of achieving anything.
It's a big thing as well from the Marxist perspective, almost, in that a lot of the Burnham stuff and a lot of the Francis stuff really is quite compatible with some people who actually understand theoretical, like, Marxist-Leninism. It's a great angle to inculcate those people from if they're capable. Well, many of them won't be, unfortunately, because many of them don't understand their own theory anyway.
In here somewhere is Althusser, who's one of those kind of better, slightly more prescient Marxists than opposed to some of the more utopian nonsense.
Some more nuts and bolts Marxism, but that's it. Very much is the element that is missing from a lot of the, especially like right wing populist rhetoric of now, is this analysis of the managerial class and this analysis of friend enemy distinction and the impossibility of neutral policy, and how you end up with a lot of populism and a lot of right-wing thought in the US, essentially boiling down to, like, return to press fresh prince arguments. It's like, didn't you guys like the past? Don't you guys like the 90s? Can't we just go back to when we lived in this magical post-racist society in the 90s, guys? And it's this big appeal to the neutral point, or the neutral point, as we talked about before, for some people's in the 50s. They just want to go back to, you know, the mid-1950s, live in the suburbs, have a big old Buick, and they don't realize that that period in history is really like peak pause.
Well, I'm trying to remember what's the... Because this will come up in a bit I want to talk about sort of later if we get into it, which is the revival of thinkers that are pretty much lost or unheard of, but obviously looks at, is it Nicolo Gomez Davila, or whatever his name is. There's a quote from him that is something along the lines of, you know, he who says he is, you know, who is from his time or exists within his time just happens to agree with the greatest number of fools present in any moment.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I think I've heard him say that one before. Yeah, whoever is, you know, basically people who agree with the current thing are idiots. Is the long and short of it, but in a much more intellectual way.
But that also works through time.
Yes. And you look at whatever time period it is, whoever is agreeing most with the current thing is merely agreeing with the largest amount of idiots at the time. That's a good one. I like that one. Right, we have one more quote from the book, and then we'll do a bit more freeform discussion. But this is kind of the third area I want to highlight on this. I guess it's slightly narrower review of Populist Delusion, because I don't want to ruin the whole thing. I just recommend people read it.
Well, no, the review in shorthand is go read it. I mean, there is no other answer. It is go read it. If you've not already read all the elite theory stuff, or if you've only read some of it, or you know, if you've at least read one of the sort of thinkers that has been talked about, they will probably be mentioned in here. And from that, it will hopefully give you links from then to other thinkers to then go and find more stuff.
Vehement in the chat has put the quote in there. It's Nicolas Gomez-Devlia.
I was going to say that's a different one, though. Ideas of the left give birth to revolution. The revolution give birth to ideas of the right. I suppose... A certain sense.
We'll talk about Gottfried here, though. This is from his chapter on Gottfried. So he's talking about the ways that the left uses to essentially discredit dissident action and hand wave it away. He talks about two before this, and then this is the third. He says, however, the third and most insidious method is to treat the unwanted behavior as a form of sickness, to depict unfashionable thinkers and retrograde views as pathological. Gottfried is rightly perturbed at the implications of treating dissident as a form of mental illness, which requires psychiatric remedy. The pathologizing tendency has its overt post-war roots in the work of the Frankfurt School, and specifically Theodor Adorno's, the authoritarian personality type. Gottfried gives a full... by the way, just a quick side note, we talked about at one point the... West German policy of placing abandoned children with pedophiles, which was directly based on Adorno's work in the authoritarian personality type, and pathologizing the normal impulses of the German men of the 1940s. Gottfried gives a full treatment to this text in his earlier work After Liberalism, to which Multiculturalism and the Political Policies of Guilt was a sequel. Elsewhere, he is at pains to point out that contrary to certain right-wing conspiracy theories, which suggest that the injection of the Frankfurt School thinking into Western institutions was a Marxist plot hatched from Moscow, that Adorno was sponsored by an emphatically liberal but also anti-Soviet sponsor, the American Jewish Committee. Oh boy, here we go. In other words, there is not subversion of liberalism by communist agitators. This is the logic of managerial liberalism played out to its natural limits. Impactful paragraph there with a whole lot of implications, especially with the mention of the American Jewish Committee, because that is just a matter of fact. This is also why people scream and cry about any mention of the Frankfurt School in general being some sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, because you can't read the Frankfurt School and you can't look at its history without noticing certain things.
No, it is an interesting section he's got here, though, because I think we have talked about this idea that what he's talking about at the top here, that this the therapeutic solutions to dissent, and specifically to right-wing dissent. I mean, arguably there's been many therapeutic sort of solutions to left-wing dissent, and that actually some of them have functioned on both ends as well. But that's a natural outcome partially of the revolution of mass and scale. The density and the rule by experts, as it were. You know, I think I really want to go back to it now, because every time I come through other stuff, there seems to be this bizarre notion. I think possibly Robert Higgs wrote about it, and maybe Gottfried too. And I know there's the whole thing from Foucault about the sort of the bourgeois nature of the concept of public health, and how that has always been one of the avenues for... Oh God, is that bloody House of Commons, dude? Right, I have a rough idea who you are. Goodbye. Just go away, please. But no, it seems to me that there is always this avenue that is worked towards by so many different thinkers, and this is one of the things why we pulled Ted Kaczynski into some of the stuff we looked at from Gottfried about the therapeutic state. Is that the technical managerial state seeks to, you know, use all of its scientific advances to fix you. This seems to be the essence of it at the moment, really. And it comes back to one of the other things Gottfried talks about, which is the kind of inversion of the state from the position of patron to the position of exploiter.
I'm still here. Sorry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I muted then unmuted my headphones. Sometimes I don't know which is which. The therapeutic state stuff is stuff we'd covered before. I always seem to sneeze a lot during these streams, so I tend to mute when I have my horrendous sneeze attacks. Yeah, the therapeutic state is something we've talked about during the stream, and especially the psychoanalyzing aspects and the pathologizing aspects of the treatment of non-normative thought. Quite literally the idea that if you don't like reality, you have to be put on antidepressants. That's one of the, you know, the major expressions of the modern therapeutic state. But treating, again, it gets very re-education camp very quickly when you start talking about the populist or distant right, or anyone who they consider as an ideological enemy, that these people need treatment, these people need help, these people need to have this somehow medicated or therapeutically brought out of them. And that it is a very insidious thought, because you're essentially saying that anyone who thinks outside of the prescribed system is insane, and they can only be made sane by thinking inside the prescribed system. And it's almost worse than saying that they're evil. It's almost worse. At least that has some bite to it. At least then there's kind of an end point of these people are bad and we do stuff to them. It's an extra step in that. It's these people are bad, so we're gonna put a fucking Neuralink in them and make them like their pod.
But in the same sense as well, it's because they have goals and sort of outcomes that you wish to use us to meet. And some of these are, you know, stupid things about progress or green tech or crap like that. And some of these are, you know, neocon goals of like the security state. And and what we witness nowadays really is the conflict of elites, is these different sort of agendas fighting for supremacy over media perception. And that, you know, I might just continue to use the phrase because I find it quite funny, but each of them are on their own trying to seize the means of innovation, as it were.
Yeah, seize the means of innovation. I like that one. It's a I'm sorry, I've just seen who that person was you timed out, and it's some rather extreme cringe LARPy wignettery. Oh dear.
No, I've seen that channel get shared about in like Telegram servers before, and I just know from like that name and the titles they write, it's like nope, nothing to do with me.
Oh dear. It's very, very, very glow. Speaking of glow, we have some donations here. We have $5 from Glow in the Dark. I'm not sure if this is the same Glow in the Dark as Glowy is with the other donations, but it might be. Donated $5 to the Super Chat. He says, people only need to see how people used to write in the 1700s and 1800s and compare it to today's writings to see the decline. The decline in reading age is very real. And I'm quite glad in that the stuff that we've been reading here, this is good. It has a very high, you know, actual reading age. It's actual academic language, but it's also quite understandable. It walks that line quite well. But yeah, a lot of what you'll encounter with the distant right literature is not an easy read. It's very normie proof. That's a big filter in of itself, in that this stuff is not easy to read, it's not easy to understand, and it's certainly not easy to like properly actualize and contextualize and absorb. to be able to do all of those.
I think that's maybe the thing, though, that people need to not necessarily just have the, you know, the understanding of the text itself. They need to understand sometimes what the text is trying to achieve. And some writers don't explicitly always set that out because they assume you understand that through the content. And sometimes that's right, sometimes that's not. But I think that, you know, maybe there's one last sort of thing to talk about. People need to understand that The Populist Delusion is not a book that necessarily argues for positions or anything like that. You know, it comes to a conclusion about populist political strategy, but its main role is to function as analytical description of how power functions.
Yes.
And again, in that way that we keep coming back to, you know, it uses tautologies about things we would otherwise think of as givens, and shows us how there are other things within that we need to understand.
And I think also like it was mentioned in the Schmidt section about seeing the liberal order from outside itself.
Yes.
And therefore trying to not fall into the traps of all these assumptions, which ultimately, you know, the Trump campaign and the Brexit stuff did.
Mm.
It very much bought into the myths of history.
Well, see, I was going to go into there was the review from Greg Johnson on Countercurrents, which...
Before you do, there's a couple more donations to go through.
All right, cool.
$3 donation here. It says, when was the last time we had a Howard Hughes? He was a rich guy. He was off the reservation. Now every rich person seems beholden to the managers of government. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. But I think maybe the last guy who kind of did that was John McAfee, honestly. He became the rogue millionaire, which is very rare. I commented on it at the time, but it's almost amazing how rare it is that people with fuck you money don't go fuck you. And it's very, that's a very omen activating thing when you think about it. That these people have the money to be off reservation, yet the vast majority of them don't do it. And that's mostly because that they'll get murdered in a Spanish prison if they do. That's the real thing here. You probably there's probably some people who've tried that, who've started to go off piste, and they've been capped, you know, essentially on their way up, because they're somebody who's not inculcated in this. Like, never forget the ability and the willingness of them to just, you know, to just Seth Rich and Duncan Lempu. Yeah, you'll get very Branch Davidian very quickly if you get go off reservation, and that's why we don't see these people. Because they put the people who do, they put their heads on spikes. Anyway, it's there's a counter currents review of Nina Panini's bread theory.
I don't quite understand it. I read it the other day, and I think maybe it's either that he doesn't understand what the book is for, or he's essentially ignoring what it's saying and its conclusions because, for want of a you know, more concise sort of phrase, what A writes in large part here, BTFO's a large part of the white nationalist platform and the identitarian platform. Not because he says it doesn't work, but because he says that you can't, you know, to use the line here, Pervini uses democracy and populism as interchangeable throughout this book. I have no quarrel with this, since both terms have been used to refer to the idea of popular sovereignty, to use Abraham Lincoln's word, government of the people, by the people, for the people. Why does Parvini think the idea of popular sovereignty is a delusion? Simply because he looks around the world and does not observe self-governing peoples. Government of the people, by the people. Instead, he sees some people governing other people. Specifically, minorities governing majorities. Therefore, majority ruler popular governments are illusions. But this does not follow. Like, what?
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 But where? You've just said you can't point to one. So okay, where is the majority?
I don't think you could ever point to one. And I know what he's trying to say is that this notion of there is no government that has never, you know, I can't think of one, a government that has ever said we are not for the people, we are not for some people. I mean, that is the nature of all government, and that is the nature of how politics works. You have to, as much as you declare who the enemy is, you also have to uplift your friends so that they know to come to where you are. And give you the power that you need and the ability to use just, sovereignty.
A lot of what this book does, and it goes into it when he talks about Mosca, and it goes into it when he talks about Prato, it's very, very basic stuff about the division of labor. When you get into the nuts and bolts of the elite theory, it's, look, just through the way that labor is divided and the way that human beings' brains work and distribute, you know, the way that attributes are distributed between them, you will always have rule by a few of many. It is unavoidable. It is a immutable fact of human existence that you will be a ruler or you will be ruled.
Yes.
And there is no way around that. There is no way around the minority exercising power over the majority. And the managerial state is actually a way of obfuscating that and actually enhancing that power differential by saying it doesn't exist anymore. That's the nuts and bolts of this, and if you're not capable of understanding that, this book isn't for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, we could sit and go through more of this, but I think I would rather get into why I think, and I'll get to the source in a moment. Back up. I think we are coming to a sort of point, you know, as you said, or as you quoted from Schmidt. No, but we weren't saying that Johnson doesn't, you know, ignores the iron law of oligarchy, but he sort of states it in a certain sense and then tries to sidestep the realities of saying it's or acknowledging it. At least that's what it seems like to me. But partially,
just really badly written.
I think his misunderstanding comes from the fact that he's trying to argue from a position of some kind of norm, and that norm in some sort of tangible sense still relies on some of the assumptions put forward in just 20th century politics in general. And that by, you know, doing as what Schmidt asks you to do, but suggests you do, if you fully step outside of it, you are now looking in, and you don't have any values that you can use to measure the thing you're looking at, because you're not standing from a position where you can measure it. You can only look at it as a whole, see what actual characteristics it has as a whole. Before that, you need sort of tools. And those are the things we've sort of talked about earlier, the friend-enemy distinction, the iron law of oligarchy, all these other aspects, the revolution of mass and scale. And at that point, what you're doing is similar to what the Austrian school people do. And I think that's maybe why the term school maybe could come before canon, because you need to have the, you know, the analytical work done first before you can then engage in higher theory and then ultimately into historical narrative content.
I would argue that the stuff contained in the populist illusion is what a lot of the paleo-libertarian stuff was moving into, but is still lacking.
Yes.
It's where it went and then went no further. Because it is really, the two hands are kind of reaching over each other and building this ideological bridge between these two different places, between what is ostensibly seen as fascism and what is ostensibly seen as wet libertarianism in some circles. You have the elements from each coming together and saying exactly the same things in almost exactly the same ways. I know, does Hopper quote Gottfried in, I'm sure he does, in some of his works.
I think there's possibly one or two of his essays where he touches on more cultural things, where he pulls in. But yeah, but you've got to remember as well that he is all over folk like de Juvenel, Cunel Leyden.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the writers contemporary really to people like Burnham at the time. And I just think it's kind of interesting. We can sort of look at ourselves in the position the Austrian school was in, you know, many, many decades ago. Maybe we aren't still as formalized yet as they were, but I mean, actually, if you think about it, the fact that at the time, maybe all the way back to the 40s and 50s, it was really just groups of like people in a cafe or somebody's front room just discussing ideas. So maybe we are about as formalized as they were. But, you know, at that time, it was a school. It was a school of thought, and that's what it was referred to. I would just think it's kind of interesting to read the introductory section to An Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought by Rothbard, because he goes into talking about how he's doing this somewhat, and I just think it's kind of interesting. As the subtitle declares, this work is an overall history of economic thought from a frankly Austrian standpoint, that is, from the point of view of an adherent of the Austrian school of economics. This is the only such work by a modern Austrian. Indeed, only a few monographs in specialised areas of the history of thought have been published by Austrians in recent decades. Not only that, this perspective is grounded in what is currently the least fashionable, though not the least numerous, variant of the Austrian school, the Misesian or praxial logic. Now, we could go on here and read loads and loads of other bits. You know, he talks about this idea of, you know, if Adam Smith created economics much as Athena sprang full-grown and fully armed from the brow of Zeus, then his predecessors must be foils, little men of no account, and no short shrift was given in these classical portrayals of economic thought to anyone unlucky enough to precede Smith. Always think that that's great.
But, you know, I love his shtick about Adam Smith invented economics and capitalism, and Locke low key invented freedom. No one was free and nobody traded anything before those people were born.
I think that there's this notion that we will not come upon a holistic set of ideas that we could form and sell as an ideology all in one go. We will have to continue to, you know, chip away, go back to the elite school thinkers, what did they have to say on this, go back to other thinkers who are either verifying the same conclusions or talking about similar phenomena. You know, I mean, this is what we have tried to do and what I have consequently done with some of the stuff where I've looked at, like, Lenin or someone like that, where he's confirming much of the things that are stated in the conclusions of work like Elite Theory or conclusions of the work of Alul, where you must think about politics in a really high level, sort of technical manner. And it is the building of that stuff that really gets us our canon, as we might call it.
Yes. It's, I don't know. Sometimes I think we need a literal canon to fire people out of, but that might come later. But you're right in that there's a divide to be bridged here, in that there's the Juvenel stuff that contains a nemesis in a lot of detail. There's the bit of Juvenel stuff in this. There's the, obviously, you've got Mosca, Prato, Gottfried, Francis, all of this stuff being unified together. And there's a lot, a lot more besides as well. When I did my essay at the Shieldings thing, I talked about the fact that, you know, you can really bridge a lot of the Austrian school and the paleo libertarian stuff from the scholastics right through the harder edge stuff of what was the English liberal tradition, and then going on to the continental tradition of criticizing a lot of what came out of the French Revolution. There's a lot of threads to pull on here, and they all go back to quite similar places. The same with the elite theorists as well. They come from relatively similar roots and similar modes of thought. It's all attacking the problem from different angles and with different language, but ultimately a lot of these thinkers come to the same conclusion, which is that, you know, egalitarianism isn't possible. It's one of the unifying factors of all of this. There's all of these unifying threads in this canon of thought that makes it a canon of thought. It's not, if you look at the backgrounds these people come from, you've got the Juvenal, who's seen as a bit of an oddball. You've got Prato, whose political stuff is verboten, but his economics is very much mainstream in certain circles. You've got Mosca, who still gets criticized as just being a fascist. You've obviously got people like Evola and the more esoteric people and the traditionalists and perennialists that come at the modern world from a less empirical, but a much more almost like totalizing perspective as in man's place in it. And all of this fits together like a jigsaw. And you're right that it hasn't been examined yet. It hasn't been fully examined yet. As we'll move to in a little bit, there's also Hansom and Harper's call for a grand historical narrative, a grand historical libertarian narrative, but it can really be a grand historical narrative that incorporates that also includes whatever this is. Because that's the direction that Harper was moving in.
That is the essay I've looked at, split up over two streams. And it's kind of interesting because he is more talking about engaging in the actual work of a study, not so much the need of the whole canon. But I think that's maybe, you know, part of the process of that is building all the different little bits. I think there's quite a nice little bit from his, I think this was originally delivered as a speech and then ends up in an essay in The Great Fiction.
Okay.
The coming of age with Murray. There is some of the ones about these are actually quite nice. It's kind of touching just to hear him talk about, you know, what it was like to kind of just like hang about under the wing and watch of Murray Rothbard. As this sort of person who was very much like a Misesian and Rothbardian and an anarcho-capitalist, but didn't see himself as a sort of fluent and as really positioned on cultural stuff, and how really Murray Rothbard, someone who is not lauded as someone as being culturally sort of up or even sort of literary, if you ask some people, they wouldn't really know because they've not touched some of his later essays or some of his larger works. He very much cared about culture and history and events, and it was just his way of looking at them was so analytical that people, you know, they kind of missed the woods for the trees, a bit like they do with something like The Populist Delusion or other books like The Machiavellians, where Burnham was sort of charged with, I think not just in The Machiavellians, but also in Managerial Revolution, he's sort of charged with this label of supporting what's going on. It's like, well, he's not supporting it. He's describing it in such an analytically concise fashion that to someone who doesn't understand that, it looks like he supports it. Anyway, I shall carry on. But above all, it was Murray who taught me never to trust official history, invariably written by the victors, but to conduct all historical research instead like a detective investigating crime. Always first and foremost, and as first approximation, follow the money in search of a motive. Who is to gain, whether in terms of money, real estate, or sheer power from this measure or that? In most cases, answering this question will lead you directly to the very actor or group of actors responsible for the measure or policy under consideration. Simple as it is to ask this question, however, it is much more difficult and requires often arduous research to answer it, and to unearth, and from a huge smokescreen of seemingly high-minded rhetoric and pious propaganda, the hard facts and indicators, the money flows and welfare gains, to actually prove a crime and to identify and out its perpetrators. Murray was a master in this, and at a time when you did not have access to computers, the internet, search machines such as Google, to do this detective's work, as I learned from Murray, you must go beyond official documents, the MSM, the big and famous names, the academic stars, and the prestige journalists. In short, everything and everyone deemed respectable and politically correct, you must also, and in particular, pay attention to the work of outsiders, extremists, and outcasts. I.e., to disrespect or deplorable people and obscure publication outlets that you are supposed to ignore or not even know about. To this day, I have heeded and indeed relished following this advice. Anyone who could see my list of bookmarks and frequently visited sites would likely be surprised, and any establishmentarian or leftist in particular would likely be shocked and shudder in disgust.
It's great because he's describing a framework for distant action in terms of research and thought and knowledge. It's very prophetic. Again, we've talked about the Rothbard time machine a few times on here. But it is very prophetic. You get a lot of this, essentially their movement petering out in the 90s. It's really, they've had a bit of a shot, they've had a bit of success. It's the same thing with San Francis, and the 90s is this routing point for both the distant right and the distant paleo libertarians and all of that. And it is heartening to see this, to see it on paper and see that we're in a kind of a similar position. But what he's calling for is what we're doing, and what the populist delusion ultimately does, and it acts as a piece of writing that is completely and totally outside of the myths of the current. It is completely dissident in its action, and not in a cringe way, to put it like that, not in a deliberately edgy or showy way, in an analytical way. And that's why it's quite important. I said one of the things I would slightly fault it on is how slightly current some of the examples are, but it kind of has to engage with people. Mm. That's kind of neither here nor there. That's more of a style thing.
Well, that's if anything, is possibly him taking some lessons from someone like Bernays himself, and using good propaganda to speak at people where they are. I believe is the phrase. No, this is actually, I would recommend people read this essay, because there's some lovely little kind of just like tidbits of stuff he drops in here.
There's also been a lot of people who've tried to prod AA to talk about some of the more economic stuff before. So I guess this can scratch their itch a little bit, and they're actually talking about the Austrian school a little bit here. But bridging this all, there's a lot of people I've encountered on the internet who latch onto, who latch onto a extremely specific area of dissident right thought, and they try and push that to the exclusion of all else. And you really have to be good at identifying what is and isn't properly anti-regime, and fuse that stuff together, because it is becoming quite a wide pantheon.
I think you need two separate people for that, though. I mean, you've got someone like Apostolic Majesty, not to say that he can't fuse content together, he probably can very well, but his specialization is very obviously history stuff, and because of that, he has a vast amount of knowledge around that subject, and will continue to grow a vast amount of knowledge around that subject. Just by the nature of the division of labour, we need, as much as I talked about the nature of specialisation beforehand, we do still need to make use of it.
Oh yes, I know, but it's the point I'm making is that you get these people who are very, very defensive of their little corner of whatever this is, and say that other people's corners aren't part of it when they are. Which is wrong.
I think that's maybe wrong, because we don't think people do it in the correct fashion. Is that maybe more the issue there? And that
you need to gatekeep, but you also need to realize when people are actually your allies, and not just spurge out because they might do things in a slightly different way to you, and might have a slightly different. You can't have the division of labor if you're desperately trying to stop other people from carrying out their labor.
No, I get what you mean.
There's a whole slew of people who get very upset that other people are, say, Austrians, astroeconomics, or paleo-libertarians. And there's other people who aren't paleo-libertarians, who might have a little bit of anti-regime thought in the libertarian sphere, who get very appalled by the elite theory stuff and what they see as like proto-fascism. And you get all this stuff where people aren't able to bridge that divide. They aren't able to both realize the utility of Schmidt and someone, you know, someone like Spengler, and also the utility of someone like Mises. They aren't able to hold the fact that you can fuse both together in their mind, because they think, oh, libertarian Austroeconomics isn't compatible with Nazism. What are you doing? And they've not read the text, and they don't understand what's being said.
Mm.
And that's really what it comes down to, is that you really need to, like, just read, nigga, read. It's like you can't push the books in people's faces. That's why, again, something like the Populist Delusion, like Nemesis, are so good, because they're great entryways. If you understand a bit of it but you want more, they're great little reference guides. I will say that I didn't read De Juvenal until I read Nemesis. And it worked as a great kind of glance guide for me to go through his original trilogy of On Power, Pure Theory of Politics, and, oh shit, what's the other one? I put myself on the spot here. But anyway, Sovereignty, that's it. Sovereignty, On Power, and Pure Theory of Politics, which is a great trilogy. I'd recommend reading it. I'm currently working up an article that uses bits of it. But all of this is a great way to get it. Again, the Machiavellians that you mentioned, there's a lot of essentially what is secondary literature about this, the older canon of writers that he's got to get into. It really is a horse to water thing, mm-hmm. Glow in the Dark. There's a lot of people out there who fancy themselves as dissident thinkers.
You can take the retards to the library, but you can't stop them chewing the pages.
It really is just like a lot of people, I'm sorry to them, they need to disappear back into the woodwork and read for a couple of years. Because that's essentially what we learn. We're not trying to push ourselves too heavily in terms of a lot of the different aspects of this, because really we're still researching here. We're still in the building phase, and we have a lot more reading to do as well. I know there's still quite a few books on the shelf you haven't read yet, Evelyn, and you're working through them, to your credit.
It's a continuous process, though.
You
always churn through texts, and then when you have some work that sort of relates to them, you then come back to them, as I have with some stuff that I've been working on. So it's a never-ending process. I mean, I think maybe the important thing is the fact that we need people who are kind of willing to kind of do as I have done for the last little while, which is basically be like, to hell with normal kind of living and the concept of a career and other stuff. I would rather commit my time to all of this kind of stuff, because otherwise it's not going to be there for the next group of people. Charlemagne said secondary literature is more important because it connects all the thinkers together and contextualizes them in a contemporary frame. Yeah, that's what we're talking about, this sort of notion that people are, you know, they're going back to the elite school, they're going back to different thinkers, and, you know, they're going all the way back to someone like Robert Filmer, and then using that idea of sovereignty that he has today so that we can understand better what politics is today.
Raymond Harmon, no. I would say that if learning and building processes is never ending, all that means is that your solutions will continuously get better. Is what it means. It's not the solutions are unobtainable, it's that the solutions you're able to come up with, the more ingrained you are, the better you are with the theory, the better you are with linking it together, the better you are with the secondary stuff, the better your solutions will become. It's like saying that having to sharpen your sword means your sword will never be sharp. That's not true at all.
Well, no, I think there is also a fact that, I mean, I know I do, and I think you do as well. We have an element of respect for a lot of the people in our circles, because some of the people you wouldn't expect sometimes, and some of the people you would expect, are incredibly well-read. And that, you know, me and you, between us, are going to spend years and years catching up to these people. And as much as we like to contribute, there is maybe some things that we have sort of held fire on or are hanging back on taking to another step, because we would rather, you know, invest maybe even years of time if needed into reading, as Charlemagne saying, you know, all the secondary content, all the contemporary content from a historical period that you're looking at, you know, trying to dig up the stuff, as Papa was saying in this essay we're looking at here about the things that people hadn't dug up before because they were told not to, but actually within them is these hidden nuggets of truth that once added to what you were working on before all of a sudden gives you a whole new conclusion or further strengthens your conclusion.
Yeah, there's a Patrius von Kempen in the chat there talks about the Renaissance humanists and how they were able to connect by a common canon, a common essentially reading list, and able to use that as a way to signify who is and isn't friend.
Mm.
And they were very present in the institutions, in the king's institutions at the time, because they were seen as, you know, necessary learned men, and that's how they became a second power center.
That's what the Communist Internationals were. They were reading groups.
Yes.
That was what the Iskra and the Inner Circle and what became the propaganda outlet for Lenin's Vanguard was just a Marxist reading circle.
At the point that, again, that people are misinterpreting it a little bit, people do still need to take action. I'm just saying that a lot of people, I think, need to be brought up to a minimum level of knowledge, honestly, if they want to partake in the discussion in a meaningful way. Not everyone will do, though. Not everyone does need to be up for this stuff. And if you're not up for the intellectualizing side of it, there is still, like we talk about in the Division of Labor, there is still plenty of other stuff that you can do, and plenty of other stuff if you encounter people who aren't, you know, who are never going to be inculcated into this in an intellectual way. There are still things they can do. It's something, again, I'm currently working on. If I do end up doing a speech at Shieldings this year, I'm going to talk about that, about the non-intellectualizing aspects of this and how important they are. And how we can interface with them and need to be honest with ourselves about them. But this, in terms of the people who are ostensibly the vanguard, they need a very good knowledge base of what they're talking about so that they can educate others, so they can have, you know, the rung beneath them, as it were, in the structure, have at least enough knowledge to carry out their functions. And ultimately, that's what this is, though. We need knowledge that helps us carry out our function. What is our function? Our function is ostensibly to win. Our function is ostensibly to put the print on the world that we want on the world, and to live in the world that we desire rather than the world that they desire. And as I keep expressing to people, the way to do that is to essentially radicalize yourself and turn yourself into somebody who is at least in thought a revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you wrote, it's on this channel, you wrote your speech, you know, Lessons from Revolutionaries and Antidote to Reformism, which I'd encourage people to go and watch. But that really is what you should be doing. You should be trying to build within yourself a certainty in what you believe in. And a lot of this stuff is very foundational to that, because it's, if you are from this ideological bent, if you do agree with these things, then it's undeniable. And the language is undeniable.
No, it's... I think we need to be a bit more humble sometimes and recognize how much of what we're doing is still in its infant stages.
Mm.
You know, as you said, action is important. Action is vital. But action that happens at the wrong time is useless, if not actually sets you back.
It's counterproductive, yes.
So, you know, we can't even really answer the question of when do we engage in action. So let's keep reading and hopefully we find out. You know, let's keep taking all the different thinkers that we're engaging with and smash their ideas together. And hopefully at some point something is spat out that either is a product of all these thinkers or is something that is even greater than the sum of the parts. And the way that, you know, I think if you were to look at the elite school, it's on the face of it a much more interesting concept than the writing of Pareto or the writing of Mosca or the writing of Robert McKells. You know, as you said, these are subjects people don't touch. The only people that really read this stuff are, you know, it's like inner baseball for real political nerds and like real heavy duty actors.
Yeah.
It's not the stuff you're going to read at university. And if you do, it's probably because you're very high up or you're studying under someone who's a specialist in this stuff, in which case you're probably very lucky. So it gets people's foot, or the, shall we say, the frontal lobe in the door. By introducing into the, you know, it's the elite school. It's not just, you know, oh, here's these two Italian guys.
Yeah, it is. It's the canon, like you said. It's if you can't attack it from one angle, look at it from another angle. And it gives you a lot more angles here. And it's in isolation, Praetor and Mosca aren't as powerful without each other, and they aren't as powerful without the framework around them. They aren't as powerful without the examples from modernity. You need all of that together, and that's what really is forbidden from people who study this as like an academic curiosity. They're looking at it through a different lens, as it were. They're looking at it as a historical piece rather than as a vital piece of writing that interlinks extremely well with a large amount of what we know today and what we see today.
Mm.
And that really is the divide there. And it's what people don't want.
To sort of fully answer Raymond Harmon's question, because he's added a sort of addendum to there. So what I'm hearing, not to be rude here, is that there is no real actionable solution. There is no real actionable solution that is tangible to us, for we do not have the resources. So we are either going to have to think of something much more clever, or we're going to have to think of ways to get ourselves more resources. I'm not, you know, I don't know, maybe people think of me as a cynic sometimes, but I'm always a cynic because I'm always looking for the solution to the problem. And that's why I'm happy to always come back to the idea that, we are in, baby steps, infantile stages, because at least we know if we're acting from there and we're conscious of the fact that we are there, we're moving in the right direction. That's a start.
I think a lot of people are, it's not a question of managing expectations, really, but it is a question of knowing where you are, knowing what you are, and knowing that, like, the Populist Delusion as a book is evidence of a nascent examination rather than a mature one.
Mm.
It is a starting point, not an end point. It is something that has been created at the beginning of a re-evaluation of a lot of these thinkers and picking up from threads from, the 70s, the 50s, these scattered remnants of what was before. But it is really a at-a-glance guide for people who are more engaged. It isn't something that is revelatory, and it isn't something that is, a guide to action. It is there as a starting point and a modern recontextualization of all these important thinkers and all these important points to rip people from their populist delusion, to make them think and make them reevaluate how they're doing things strategically in terms of theory. Because we might think, we actually run the risk of getting too far ahead of ourselves ideologically in many cases, in that the people that could be useful to us who are still engaged in the last version, let's say, of what is the bleeding edge of dissent action really need to be ripped away from that.
Mm.
Their belief in the system, their belief in populism as an end, maybe, they might think that there's a populist solution to democracy. They might think democracy is bad, but they might also still believe that they can reform it or change it or remove it from within inside the system, and that really isn't possible. Really isn't possible without
You can't vote yourself out of a democracy.
No.
I mean, it's such, again, it's like a tautology. People are like, well, yeah, of course, but like, yeah, think about it. You can't vote yourself. You can't have a majority decree that majority decrees are invalid. This is just such simple logic, but we don't grasp it because we don't say these things and then think about them for any extended period after that sometimes. I mean, I think that's why understanding, again, another concept brought up in the book, like the political formula as a conscious construction of rhetoric and ideology in a form that can be consumed and does point people in the right direction is so important. And why, when you were saying, when you de-intellectualize stuff, it's not just about boiling it down, it's about boiling it down into the right thing and also bringing it down to the right level. You might not want to bring some of the lessons from the populist delusion down to the man in the pub level, but you might find someone at your work or at university or something who is somewhat interested in ideas and is somewhat open to already slightly anti-egalitarian ideas, would be the time to sell them on this idea of the elite school.
I mean, I think, would also say, you can't boil the ideas down without having the ideas in the first place. That's where this kind of like the rich stew, as it were, of all of this. We're trying to make nice concentrated stock here, but you can't do it without boiling the ingredients first, to use a cooking analogy. You've got to have the big, frilly, at length proof work to get your very simple formula.
There's a goose in the chat. At risk of sounding dumb, did the Germans not vote themselves into a one-party state? The Germans voted themselves out of a state. But arguably, I don't know, was Was he really the most popular man in Germany in 1933 and 1938? We'll never know.
Well, they ultimately happened, though, is someone had to take a decision to dissolve the Reichstag. There was this fire. Technically,
can we start using that as like a Joe Biden style message? You know, the most popular man in
1933. No, I the thing is that you can't vote yourself out of a democracy if your elites aren't already heading in that direction. Because that was really the direction that Germany was heading, whether he won those elections or not. That's the real point there. That a lot of that was used as a legitimizing force. I don't think there's a great point to be made that I don't think you can see that as the Germans voting themselves out of democracy. You can see that as a Nazi party using democracy as a tool to legitimize itself.
80 million votes, guys.
Because they had ostensibly already won. That's the reality of politics, folks. To even stand in an election, really, and have any chance of being elected, you have to already have sacrificed quite a lot to the power structure.
As the phrase goes, the elites elect themselves.
Yes, they select themselves as well.
Hmm.
6 million votes, oh no. Most votes in German history. Yep. Most popular man in 1936 is a pretty good one. We should stick with that one. We are coming somewhat towards the end here, but we still have a little bit of time left. Is there anything or any other points you wanted to cover before we move into more of a roundup and thank yous and general stream closing out stuff in the last 10 minutes?
No, nothing really comes to mind. I suppose we shouldn't waffle on too long. I think I noticed someone in chat saying earlier on that they wouldn't come back and watch it because it'll be like 4 hours long, and someone else was like, oh, it'll only be about an hour and a half. And I'm like, that's novel. So I think, I don't know, maybe we should make our niche like the great like 90-minute streams.
We do try and keep them quite rigidly to a structure, and we do try and keep them quite rigidly to a time. So if you've not seen our stuff before and you're on the fence about watching it, we don't tend to have massive 4-hour streams unless we're doing like democratization stuff, which needs to be that long. Mm-hmm. And even then, they tend to be around about 2 hours in the newer formats. If we do bring it back, which is going to be a lot of work, they'd rather be 2 hours rather than 4 hours. So we don't tend to do the massive. We are not going to do a 17-hour stream about why Star Wars is bad. That is not our style of content, and I can't imagine anything more painful than that. I actually, when it makes me tear my teeth out. But to round out, though, I'm going to give a little bit of not a speech here, but a lot of people don't think they can write, and I for a long time used to write bits and pieces and delete them straight away for years. And I, you know, we can share the anti-politics, I guess. I have a version of my speech from Nomos now completely edited. I'm going to put that out tomorrow as not to take the thunder away from this stream. But that will give us something to shill.
I can put the
link. Give me a second here. Yes. I'll put it in the chat. There we go. I've got it. I went in the chat now. It's antipolitics.substack.com. I'll have my speech from Nomos back in March on there. That gels quite well with this. It's called Where is the New Elite? It's about how the elite have suppressed the emergence of new elites beneath them. And they've suppressed the kind of the natural cycle that Prato and Mosca talk about when it comes to the renewal of the elites and the way that these groups interact with each other when they fail. It was something delivered in a room. We do real life events. If people haven't cottoned onto that, I'll have some announcements hopefully relatively soon. I'm still looking at venues and stuff, and over the long bank holiday weekend, me and Evelyn will be going through a lot of the information I've sifted.
Yep.
So we'll probably have an announcement not too far after the beginning of June for when the next Nomos event will be. If you're here in the UK, it will be in the south of England, I can confirm that much, but exactly where we don't know, because we're still trying to figure out the best venues, because prices for everything, as you know, have gone through the roof because our government decided to print a lot of money. But we don't just sit here and talk about this. We do genuinely put our ideas into practice, and go out, meet people, we talk, we stand up and give speeches about this in public. But it seems, along with possibly being involved, okay, you know, with the shielding stuff between us, we seem to do like 3 or 4 in-person speeches a year, which isn't bad for internet nobodies. But yeah, we do actually go around the press of flesh.
Yeah, I suppose it did sort of come out of nothing as well. But we've kind of just, some opportunities have arisen, some opportunities we've developed for ourselves, and we've just kind of jumped upon them, really, because we, you know, in a certain sense, it sounds a bit kind of sappy, but like, we care.
We do. We're here because we care, guys. But in that vein, I would say that if you are interested in this and you are on the fence, just start trying to organize your thoughts in long form if you haven't done it before. Well, if it's something that you think you might like.
Can I maybe close with a little bit of the Carlyle I was going to grab? Because it's just this little section on books and hero worship, and I think the section is the men of letters.
Oh, sure. We can close with that then. I thought we'd forgotten something.
No, I was wondering how to fit it in. I've just got this really zoomed in as well.
Oh yeah, no, that's good. And like I said, if I would encourage people, like, the distant right canon isn't going to write itself.
No.
And as cheesy as it sounds, it could be you points at the screen. But seriously, you guys are it. As I keep trying to tell people, it's like, look around you. As I said in my first speech at the first Nomads event, it's like, look to your left, look to your right. These might be the only people you have, so you might as well make use of it. Mm. It isn't going to come out of nothing, and a lot of people here have absorbed a lot of knowledge, and I'm always amazed by the specialist skills and knowledge that people have. So you know, create your own canon, become the dissident right writer you want to see. But go on about your men of letters. Which Carlyle text is this from?
It's from Heroes and Hero Worship. Which is,
okay.
I mean, I would just say to people, go buy the big essential political writings anthology of Carlyle, because when I got it, it was like £20, and it's like nearly 900 words, and it is all a lot of his main sort of works. And that's not to say that it's like everything of his, that's maybe like a tenth of what he's written, but it's a lot of his kind of more general stuff, unless you want to go and read the specialised stuff, which I would like to do at some point, but. You know, like 6
volumes. There you
go.
It's on Amazon. And it's a paperback. Yes.
Anyway.
But start reading. Go on. I'll put it in the chat.
Do not books still accomplish miracles as runes were fabled to do? They persuade men. Not the wretchedest circulating library novel which foolish girls thumb and con in remote villages, but will help to regulate the actual practical weddings and households of those foolish girls. So Celia felt, so Clifford acted, the foolish theorem of life stamped into those young brains comes out as a solid practice one day. Consider whether any rune in the wildest imagination of mythologist ever did such wonders as on the actual firm earth some books have done. What built St. Paul's Cathedral? Look at the heart of the matter. It was that divine Hebrew book, the word partly of the man Moses, an outlaw tending his Medantish herds 4,000 years ago in the wilderness of Sinai. It is the strangest of things, yet nothing is truer. With the art of writing, which printing is a simple and inevitable and comparatively insignificant corollary, the true reign of miracles for mankind commenced. It related with a wondrous new
I use the word contiguous quite a lot.
No, it's not contiguous, that's contiguity or whatever, is it not?
Oh, right, okay.
In perpetual closeness, the past and distant with the present and time and place, all times and places with this our actual here and now. All things were altered for men, all modes of important work of men, teaching, preaching, governing, and all else.
So I like Carlyle because he's old enough that his prose sound like verse.
Mm.
It's the same with some of the Cunard Leyden stuff that's very well written. But I think it's a good thing to close out on. The word has power. And simply reading and simply absorbing this knowledge will do something. You will get it if you read enough and you research enough and you try hard enough. It's not something that's like esoteric knowledge. It's not something that I think is beyond the grasp of most of our viewers. I actually do have quite a high opinion of our audience. Mm-hmm. You the real OGs. But I was trying to say, Yeah, if you've not been here before, we do tend to stream Thursdays. There will not be a stream this Thursday, though, for is the Long Bank holiday, and we're going out for a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be doing nice in-person.
The next stream will be, I might as well sort of announce it properly, on Monday with Philosopher Cat. And we'll be discussing, I think, the concept of what you could refer to as the third sex, or possibly the de-sexing crisis. Depending on whether or not it exists, that's up for discussion. But it's a sort of, think of it as a continued musings from the stream I did with Yez a while back called The Unsullied Perspective. But no, thank you everyone for showing up. I don't know if I really got anything else to say. I'll once again thank AA for shuffling his schedule around and moving his PSA yes. Sitch rant to 9:30 so there was no crossover.
Well, we're done here now, so you can go watch your. In fact, I will return the favor, and as pitiful as our audience is in comparison in terms of size, do go over. I can't find the link to it now. Actually, I'm trying to waffle here. I'm trying to do a handoff, and it's not working. Oh, there it is. Sorry, it just was not loading for me. We'll do a handover to AA stream then. For whenever it starts. But yeah, AA did actually move a stream so we could do this, so thank you. Thank you, Carpet Merchant. You've been very generous, and I may buy some more carpets for some people who express interest in them at some point. So I'll just say thank you for watching, and good night.
Good night.
Oof, there we go, we're off air.